So last week, Rich started us off looking at the start of the Gospel of Matthew, one of the four accounts of Jesus' life that we have in the Bible. Now Mark and Luke start their accounts clearly explaining why they're writing, to show us the evidence that Jesus is God's son and God's promised king. So how does Matthew start? Well, we saw it up on the screen earlier. He says, "This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham." He starts with the entire listing of Jesus' family tree. That's quite a strange way to open. Certainly, as I think Mark was hinting, can feel a little bit dry, not the most engaging start. But the more you do stop and look at each of those names, look at the names that we know that stand out, that are familiar, the more you examine the other four characters that it digs up, the more amazing the implications you find of the way God works and of the way God chooses to bring about his plan of salvation that culminates in Jesus, and of who that plan of salvation is for. The first name we're going to be examining in detail is a particularly unexpected one to find in Jesus' family line. They are not an Israelite, not one of God's chosen people. And six of the eight times they are mentioned in the Bible, their name appears with a very particular description, the prostitute. Today we're looking at Rahab. So first of all, the first section we'll be digging into the context, who was Rahab? So Rahab is first encountered in the passage that we had read by Sam, Joshua 2. This is at the time that Joshua was leading the people of Israel, God's people, before they had a land of their own. Joshua was leading them to conquer the land that God had promised them, to conquer their homeland, Israel. Way back in Genesis, God had made the promise to Abraham, the forefather of Israel. He says in Genesis 15, verses 13, it says, "Then the Lord said to him, 'Know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and that they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure.'" So the Israelites had now come through that 400 years of slavery in a foreign country, Egypt. They had been rescued out of it by God in a spectacular display of power, whereas he unleashed 10 plagues on Egypt until the stubborn Pharaoh finally admitted he can't contend with God and released them. And now they were returning. The Egyptians had freely given up their plunder to Israel. They were returning with the great possessions promised. They were returning to their homeland, Canaan, which God had promised them. And this is where our passage in Joshua picks up and where Rahab is introduced. In Joshua 2, verse 1, it said, "Then Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from Shittim. 'Go look over the land,' he said, 'especially Jericho.' They went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there." So Rahab is one of the Amorites, one of those Canaanite people living in the land that Israel was supposed to conquer. She was outside of God's people. She was not included in those covenant promises that God had made to Israel, promises to give them a land and for God himself to rule over them and protect them, and promises for them to have a special relationship with God and for them to prosper. Rahab absolutely did not deserve to be included. In fact, her people, the Amorites, stood in opposition to God's people. She was an enemy to God. But in those verses from Genesis 15, did you spot the immense mercy and patience God was showing to the Amorites living in the land verse 16, it said, in the fourth generation to Abraham, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not reached its full measure. That's quite a strange turn of phrase, I think, but God, it shows us God was not snatching a land for his people that another nation's entitled to. I mean, we know from the Bible itself anyway that the earth is the Lord and everything's in it. But we're told these people, the Amorites, have been provoking God's anger against them by their sinful ways of life, which included idol worship, even child sacrifice. And God was so merciful to even these people that he didn't give Abraham the land he was promised for 400 years. 400 years. The Amorites have had 400 years of second chances. And in that time, their sin only got worse. And they proved that they would never change. They would never turn back to God. You cannot fault God for his mercy and patience. But God is also the judge, and justice must be done. He is too good to allow evil and injustice to be done in his world and let the culprits escape justice if they refuse to change. The people to which Rahab belonged were not just outside of God's people. They were right on the brink of imminent destruction. Destruction that they had well and truly brought on themselves. And as for Rahab herself, well, we alluded earlier that the repeated description that characterizes Rahab so much in the Bible was her occupation. She was a prostitute. Not only was she a member of a nation facing God's judgment, she was guilty herself. She was unavoidably guilty. However, she was led to prostitution, she was abusing God's design for marriage and sex to make a living. She was actively living a life of sin against God. She was deserving of that judgment over the Amorites. But then an interesting opportunity presents itself to Rahab. He read two Israelite spies sent to spy out the land, particularly the fortified city of Jericho, where Rahab lived. They turn up at her door. Welcomes them in. We're moving into our second main section. We're looking at the Jericho choice, fear or faith. Jericho choice, fear or faith. So we've had this picture painted of Jericho, the first fortified city of a doomed land, the gateway for the Israelites into their promised land, and death row for the Amorites in the land, awaiting judgment from God. What was the atmosphere like in Jericho? Well, Rahab gives us some insight into the mood of the city at the time. He says in verse 9, I know that the Lord has given you this land and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. The people of Jericho weren't blind to what's happening to them. They were melting in fear. Why? Verse 10. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when he came out of Egypt, and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted in fear, and everyone's courage failed because of you. They had heard about God and his mighty work, his mighty rescue of his people from the superpower Egypt, parting a dry path for them through the sea, through the Red Sea, so that his people could cross, and letting the sea crash back over the Egyptians chasing. They had heard how he had already handed over the first Amorite kings and cities to Israel in battle before they had even crossed over the Jordan River into Israel proper. The God of Israel was clearly physically at work, winning Israel's battles, commanding nature, and performing the impossible for them. And for all the Amorites' military might and fortifications, this news was enough to crush them and cause their courage, their spirits, their hearts to melt away inside of them and dissipate like smoke. The Amorites had gods, but they weren't like this. The Amorites, the people of Jericho, were living with this awareness that God's judgment was looming over them. They knew death was hanging over them. Maybe some people in Jericho were putting their faith in their walls. Maybe some slandered the God of Israel and tried to belittle what was happening to them, act like it wasn't really that bad. Maybe some just tried to get on with their life in denial of God's judgment. But the overall unshakable effect on the people of Jericho was this withdrawal from God, hiding within their strong walls, and this kind of hyper-alertness and hostility towards Israel, which we witness in verses 2 and 3. Says, the king of Jericho was told, look, some of the Israelites have come here tonight to spy out the land. So the king of Jericho sent this message to Rahab, bring out the men who came to you and entered your house, because they have come to spy out the whole land. As soon as the king heard of the spies, effectively sends his police round to bang on Rahab's door and demand that they be turned over. How did she react? Verse 4, but the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. He said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they had come from. At dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, they left. I don't know which way they went. Go after them quickly. You may catch up with them. But she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them under the stalks of flax that she had laid out on the roof. Covers for them. He covers for the spies. No doubt the spies would be put to death upon discovery, and so being caught conspiring with them would be considered treason and a death sentence for Rahab too. By helping the spies, she is risking the trust and acceptance of everyone she has ever known in her city. Well, the soldiers buy what she said, they believe her story, and they send out a search party before promptly sealing the city gates again. So what reason does she give for recklessly hiding spies? Verse 8 to 11 says, before the spies lay down for the night, he went up on the roof and said to them, I know that the Lord has given you this land, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted in fear, and everyone's courage failed because of you. For the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below. We have noted already that Rahab, along with all of Canaan, has heard of God's deeds for Israel. But this caused a frankly appropriate fear of God to come on the nation, knowing that they were on the wrong side, this all-powerful God. But Rahab framed her report to the spies, the confession. I know the Lord has given you this land, for the Lord your God is God in heaven above, on the earth below. These recognize their God is the true God. She goes on to appeal for mercy from them. She has no claim to this. She's not one of God's people. Her whole way of life is built on breaking God's law. She deserves the judgment of God. But from what she has seen of God, she believes, she knows he is the true God. She recognizes she is helpless before God. She recognized her godless way of life is leading to a dead end. She's seen how God cares for his own people. She knows her only hope is to call out to this God. least by being led to her, has provided her the perfect opportunity to do that. From the message Rahab heard of God, she chooses to put her faith in this God and turns away from her old way of life. There is no ambiguity here. Her trust is clearly visible because it flows out into her actions. She risked her own life and standing in a city to hide the spies. And what response to God? We see her faith course in verse 12. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that you will show kindness to my family because I have shown kindness to you. Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death. She is showing she wants to align herself with God's plan and God's people as she hides the spies. And on that basis of changing her allegiance to God, she does the only thing she can before God. She begs for mercy. She appeals to God to let her into a relationship with God as one of his people. She effectively is trying to make a deal, a covenant with God's people, like God's covenant with his own people. By listening carefully to what God has done for his people, her initial fear of God led to faith in God, not withdrawal from it, like the rest of Jericho. She has heard she's under God's judgment. He is powerful, yes, but she has also heard that God is merciful to his people. He is slow to anger and rich in love. And she chooses to take a hold of his mercy. She starts from the same place as the people of Jericho. She is a sinner, an enemy of God. More than that, her way of life is offensive to God. She is on the brink of judgment. Death is hanging over her. And we see her start in that same fear as the people of Jericho. In verse 11, she includes herself. When we heard of it, our hearts melted in fear and everyone's courage failed because of you. She is helpless before God. But the difference with Rahab comes in her response to this God when they heard the fearful news of him, where Jericho's fear of God and the death awaiting them, their response is to hide, to withdraw from God and trust their walls, their only protection instead. Rahab recognizes God is the greatest danger to her, but also the greatest hope. A fear of God prompts this faith in God that says, the Lord your God is God in heaven above, earth below. And our only hopeful course of action is to beg this for help. So moving into our final third section, the grace of Joshua. Grace of Joshua. So how do the spies answer her as representatives of God's people? They say, our lives for your life, the men assured her. If you don't tell what we are doing, we will treat you kindly and faithfully when the Lord gives us this land. They accept the deal. They make the promise of safety. They promise she can trust this God and his people to treat her faithfully. Even though she is their enemy, even though she's a sinner. They claim she will be saved from the coming judgment on Jericho, provided she keeps faith in that God, provided he doesn't betray them by telling the city about their plans, and provided she ties a red cord in her window as a sign, a visible sign of her faith. In fact, her family too, anyone she tells she can convince can be saved if she warns them to stay in her house with her when Israel's army arrives. And so we see her agree to the terms, sealing the deal with God's people. And again, we immediately see her visible faith acted out as she ties the red cord in her window straight away. Verse 24 then finally tells us the spies' escape was successful, and they were able to bring back the encouraging report from Rahab. They said to Joshua, "The Lord has surely given the whole land into our hands. All the people are melting in fear because of us." But for Rahab, it was now a time of waiting. Knowing God's judgment was coming, knowing the conquering army was coming, should this God be trusted? Will she be spared? Will God's chosen leader, Joshua, treat her faithfully as the spies promised? She is helpless but to trust in his mercy. Time would tell whether Rahab's faith is genuine and whether she will really trust God to the end. Well, Joshua chapter 6 picks up the story of Jericho. God instructed Joshua and Israel in his plan to defeat this fortified city of Jericho in his power. They were to march around the city walls each day for a week, and on the seventh day, he would collapse the walls for them so that their army could just rush straight into the city. So, turning to Joshua chapter 6, starting in verse 20, we read, "When the trumpet sounded, the army shouted, and at the sound of the trumpet, when the men gave a loud shout, the walls collapsed. So everyone charged straight in, and they took the city. They devoted the city to the Lord and destroyed with the sword every living thing in it, men and women, young and old, cattle, sheep, donkey. Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, 'Go into the prostitute's house and bring her out with all who belong to her, in accordance with your oath to her.' The young men who had done the spying went in and brought out Rahab, her father and her mother, her brothers and sisters, and all who belonged to her. They brought out her entire family and put them in a place outside the camp of Israel. Then they burned the whole city and everything in it. But they put the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron into the treasury of the Lord's house. But Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute with her family and all who belonged to her, because she hid the men Joshua had sent as spies to Jericho. And she lives among the Israelites to this day." God's plan is enacted, and Israel rushed into the city to carry out God's judgment. It is a grim day as a city that was given every chance to turn back to God, but refused to change, must face justice. God's faithfulness must be upheld, and he has promised to put an end to sin. But this is a real tragedy for people like Jericho. But we also see God's faithfulness concerning Rahab is upheld too. The one person who chose to trust God in the city is saved, along with everyone she could convince to take refuge with her. God is a just judge who cannot allow the destruction and suffering of sin to carry on. He is such a patient and merciful and faithful God that anyone, even a sinner on the brink of destruction, will be saved if they put their faith in him. We saw God's leader, Joshua, took special care to uphold God's faithfulness and seek out Rahab, and carefully ensure every single person who was trusting God in her house would be saved from death. We are told her entire family were safely delivered from Jericho and put in a special place by the camp of Israel, ready to join God's people. At the time of writing Joshua, Rahab and her family, we're told, were already securely living as part of God's people. God is faithful. Rahab was saved from judgment and death. And more than that, Joshua redeemed her from her sinful way of life to become one of God's people. What an amazing turnaround for Rahab, a Canaanite prostitute. Then as we are flicking back ahead, back to that Matthew chapter 1, the start of Matthew, that family tree of Jesus, we see even more depth of love and grace with which Rahab was treated. Rahab the prostitute, became father of Boaz, the husband of Ruth, who we'll hear more about in the coming weeks. And ultimately, we see Rahab's family line, she ends up becoming an ancestor of Jesus. As Matthew draws our attention to this in the opening of his account of Jesus, he is showing us that Rahab is precisely the kind of person God wants in his people. Matthew could have easily hidden Rahab away as an embarrassment, a foreign prostitute, a blip in the plan. But no, he goes out of his way to break this pattern, this listing of fathers and sons, to show us a mother, Rahab. Rahab was conclusively brought into God's people. God was pleased to use Rahab's family line to bring about his ultimate plan of salvation with Jesus. Rahab was an undeserving outsider and sinner under God's judgment. But her response to hearing about God, hearing about his judgment on her, alongside his mercy and tenderness to his people, her response was to change and trust him. Rahab shows us that the only qualification for this list of people God used to lead to Jesus is faith. You can be anyone from any background with all kinds of sin in your past, but put your faith in God and he will treat you safely. He will welcome you into his family. For Jewish readers of Jesus' family tree, another detail would stick out when you see Rahab mentioned. The name Jesus is the Greek form of a Jewish name, Joshua. It means God saves. Jewish readers would see the name Jesus, another Joshua, listed in connection with Rahab. They would see verse 21 explaining he was given the name Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. They would be reminded of the kind of undeserved salvation the first Joshua gave to Rahab, and they would understand what Matthew is doing by mentioning Rahab. He is showing us just what kind of salvation this second Joshua will bring. Jesus, the second Joshua, saves sinners outside of his people facing imminent judgment, just like we saw with Rahab. When we see Jesus grown up, we certainly don't see him spending all his time with the most influential people in Israel or the most religious. We see him spending so much of his time with the tax collectors, the swindlers, and the prostitutes. Later on in Matthew, the religious people confront Jesus about this. Why do you spend all your time with sinners? Jesus' response in Matthew 9, verse 12, is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Jesus making his mission, why he came, very clear, is about saving sinners, like a doctor saves the sick. Just like Joshua acted with Rahab all that time ago, Jesus has came to buy back sinners into his people. This is great news. Take a look at the people around you. They might look like good, respectable people, but no, in God's eyes, we were all found to be that wicked and deprived city. We are like the people of Jericho under imminent judgment. None of us love God properly and are always devoted to him. And we all know we have death hanging over us. We are all going to face death one day. This is exactly what the people Jesus came to save are like. If you haven't done so already, you must admit your sin to him and your unworthiness and throw yourself on his mercy to rescue you. Through his death on the cross, you can have a hope of life after death. if you do already have faith in God, like Rahab, is Advent, where we remember the coming of Jesus and his mission to save lost sinners like us at any cost. He is all you need, so take the time this Advent to marvel at your Saviour. This Advent, pour over the Bible, the message about Jesus. Meditate on it, on him. Let your heart be fueled by the greatness of your God. And then be prompted, like Rahab, to take risks for him. To share that news of salvation you've got with the people around you. People you know are facing this imminent judgment. The people around us who have no faith in Jesus for salvation are facing death. But in Jesus we have the answer. So speak hope this Christmas to the people around